stand in the back of the room or something?
We're actually in the conference to talk about the man. Welcome to the panel discussion on 3103. Like you see here, sort of a representative of assorted artists and staff members. We've been around for 7 years from began 3103 in Florida, and then thank you. And moved it up to New York, where it continued as a venue for underserved musicians and artists experimenting with transmission and just wacky music and events. And recently, it's been sort of morphing into a nonprofit organization so that we can branch out. We have an educational outreach program called Radio Lab, which is sort of a version of what we're doing today. There's a event series, performance series that we're continually curating shows all over New York and increasingly the U.S. and the world. We have a dispatch series where we're 16. That are distributed in galleries and record shops. We're going to be working on a book project pretty soon about transmission arts, the history thereof, and the future. Pretty much all of this is in this fancy little handout that Tom made up. The preservation program, Tom was very foresighted in the beginning and has archived every event, or almost every event since the inception of the group. Then David Mandel invited us to perform in the psychogeographical complex because much of our work is site-specific and also it sort of goes with the agitprop history of the forum. I'm sort of delirious right now because I'm the true nomadic, you know, in the spirit of this event. I have been couch surfing for like 3 weeks and had like four hours of sleep last night. So although I prepared a long lecture, I think I'll spare you guys. And I think that what I'll do instead is introduce our artists and talk about the events that we're working with. Starting with Tom Rowe. Tom and Matt are going to be doing a project called Up the Bridge. But Tom, I was wondering if you'd also like to talk about just transmission a little bit and
power supply is down. So basically, we work with transmitters like these. This is a 40 watt FM transmitter made by a guy in Tampa, Florida called the LV Brewer. And we work with transmitters from 15 milliwatts to 100 watts, probably. Small transmitters that can get cover rooms, neighborhoods, and parts of cities, or a small town. We started as as Scott said before, as a micro radio collective in 1997, and sort of morphed into this transmission arts organization now, where we have a 13, I think, official 3.9 transmission artists that we're working with, which is Matt, myself, Michelle, Scanner, Radio Rudio, Ben Owen, who? Narrow Transmitter, 31 Down, Aaron Davidson and Melissa Stubbins, Jamie Hissera, and I'm sure forgetting someone. Matt Mikan. And we're with others, free jazz noise, other field recordings, janitor sound performers, in engaging them in using the airwaves interestingly and creatively in ways that they're not being done by commercial radio. I guess our two of our biggest, two of our most important exhibitions or installations are Tune In, which we just did at the Kitchen in April, and we did last year at the New York Center for Media Arts. Doing it again in July at the San Jose Art Institute and a couple other places in the future. But it's basically many performers, 50 or 60 usually, all playing at the FM transmitter, probably about five at a time. And the space where the performances are is quiet, because they're playing in the transmitter rather than the amplifier, and attendees get a radio with the headphones at the door to act as a performance. That's our main program. The other main program is called Radio 4x4, which has four different performers all performing into their own FM transmitter. And then we have radios spread out the space, all tuned to one of the four frequencies. And so depending upon where you go, you hear a different mix, depending on how many radios are tuned in. In Shell Channel 8 or 7 or Max Channel 91.9, something like that. So those are kind of our two core programs. And then we do all kinds of other experiments with radios, walkie-talkies, TVs, any kind of other transmission. And that's, I guess, where we're at this point. That's a small introduction. Maybe we'll get a bit more.
Yeah. Let's open it up to Q&A later. So, Michelle,
of the bridge is something me, Tom, Matt Micus, we all live like in a block radius of the Williamsburg Bridge over the last 7 or 8 years, and it totally got rebuilt, ripped down, rebuilt, and we were just kind of just collected sounds and just documented kind of the day-to-day changing of this thing that has like an important impact, I guess, because you just wake up one night and you hear a guy like sawing, it sounds like a chainsaw, but like one guy in the middle of the night working on the bridge, and it was, you know everybody in the whole neighborhood right there heard this guy chainsawing. But I guess Sunday we'll be doing a performance which shows this time-lapse video of the bridge being like reconstructed while we're using found sounds and contact microphones, kind of getting sounds off the bridge, and I don't know, it's more, and there's now there's passerbyers, because Tom's place is like 10 feet away from the bike path, so there's kind of interaction with people that walk by. I think that'll be a new something to include with the piece on Sunday. I don't know.
What time is it at on Sunday?
We started business.
Can you go up to the gallery this year?
Yeah, if you want to read the gallery at $97.
Can we also interact with you on the bridge?
Hopefully, we're going to have microphones set up to unfortunately, the bike path, the walk put down right next to it is closed down.
They reopened it this year.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Oh, they were perfect. Oh, that's awesome.
Exactly.
Yeah,
when
you said that.
They just switched it.
Okay. So then, yeah. It's very good.
Are you guys, is it transmitting on radio?
Yeah, we'll be on the
How do you guys want to, do you want to ask us questions as we go, or do you want to wait till the end?
Why don't you give your introduction?
Okay. Michelle? Michelle's working on the Echolocato project, which involves a lot of walks and field recording. Completed by a broadcast.
My name is Michelle Magai, and I'm doing the past couple of years I've had a project that's called Echolocator. Which is really designed around two ideas. One is that there's a lot of value for people in listening to the places that they live in ways that they don't normally do it. So there's just ideas of getting people to go out on sound walks where we basically walk through an area and we listen and we don't talk, we don't do anything else, we just listen. And so that's kind of one of the fundamental underlying ideas of the project, is just getting people to experience where they live in ways that they haven't before. And then the other aspect is the kind of integrating public resources like community radio or community access TV, whatever kinds of public resources there are for people to express themselves creatively, trying to integrate those resources into the project so that people can participate and then they can actually make something out of the process, and they can be part of making some like radio broadcast or TV show, or you know, putting something up on the web that other people can see. So like getting people to realize that they can be creative even if they're not artists or they're not they don't think that they have access to resources, sort of helping them discover that there are free resources just about everywhere you go. There's community access TV, there's people like Free 103 or community stations that offer training to do radio broadcasting, and a lot of opportunities for people. So the project is kind of trying to highlight both of those things. And I thought it would be great to do it in Brooklyn because I live in Brooklyn, and it's my community, and Free 103 is a great opportunity for that. So we're doing we just came from Blindfolded Sound Walk, which we were doing in Williamsburg. So we're doing a number of things each day. We're doing a blindfolded sound walk, which is basically just a private guided walk through an area of the neighborhood with a blindfold on. And then a little bit later today, I'm doing a field recording session, so getting people to come out and giving people disc recorders, tape recorders, microphones, and then showing them a little bit basic recording, and then sending them off and recording various different neighborhoods, Bushwick, Williamsburg, and Greenpoint. And then the other thing that we're doing is just public sound walks, where large groups of people will go and walk through, follow a route through a neighborhood and just listen together, which is a really interesting, also interesting process to do it with a group of people, because if you are surrounded by people and you're all engaged in the same act and you're not talking and your energy is really concentrated on this one act, I think interesting things start to happen, synchronicities start to arise, and those are basically the three things that I'm doing today, tomorrow, and Saturday, and there's a big schedule over there which you guys can grab, but it's also in the 3103. And then on Sunday, we're going to take all the field recordings that we've collected, and again, this is open to anybody who's of any age who's interested. We're going to do a radio broadcast or a broadcast of some sort, and then web stream, and that'll be at Office Ops in Brooklyn. And the address and stuff is in the flyer, but that'll be just kind of coming in, and we may set up on the roof, and we may set up inside the space, but there'll be a bunch of mixers and all the field recordings that we've collected on tape and on mini disc, and some of them will be on computer. And just people can freely come in and mix sounds together and kind of have an experience of contributing to this sound work that's going to evolve in the space. And it'll be broadcasting on radio, sort of like the 4x4, radio 4x4 thing that Tom is responsible for. It'll be similar to that, and that the sound will be getting broadcast on radios and in space. So everybody will have a chance to come in and play, basically, and kind of experiment. And source material, all of the source material is from this community of Greenpoint, Williamsburg, and Bushwick. So that's my lengthy spiel.
How are you integrating it?
It's really, well, I mean, I think a lot of people are learning about it through this event, but I'm also like standing out on the street corner asking people. I mean, all the people who went on Blindfolded Sound Walk today were just walking by, and we said, "Do you want to go on a Blindfolded Sound Walk?"
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is an ongoing project for Michelle, and this is one installment of, and so she's getting different things.
Yeah, I try to help her. I mean, it's a real challenge to actually you know, when you make community work, it's a real challenge. That's the challenge, is to get that community participate. A lot of, like, when I go to other places, I did it in Toronto and in some towns in Vermont. I don't know anybody there, and it's not my community, and I'm kind of outsider, so it's an interesting dynamic to kind of have to break
through.
Like
the organic intellectual, so.
Or something. Yeah, I try to really rely on people in those places who are interested and get them to kind of get their friends to come out, and just like word of mouth. In the fall, I'm going to do it up at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, so there will be kind of established community people that I can tap into, but I'm always trying to get, like, there's a kind of established community, like this place has an established community of artists, and then trying to get those people to spread the word to people who might not be part of this, kind of, who might not have so much access to it, because ideally, it's really about getting access to people.
If you might get out of the artist community.
Yeah. Yeah. If you have any ideas, we'll talk.
Okay. And the final member of our group here is Lex Bagat, who is a sound artist and is collaborating with 313 on this event in particular, but has worked with us in the past on a couple of events, and I'm sure in the future as well, hopefully. And his project is called Ghosting the Banshee. That's all good. Would you like to take it from
there? Yeah. Today it's a little difficult to talk about my piece because it hasn't been going as well as I was hoping. You know, Duchamp said that, like, the stuff of art is really the difference between what you intend to create and what is the end result. And I am having lots of my end result. But, this is kind of becoming Bandshell Ghost number 3, because I have a lifelong connection to the Bandshell, which was in Tompkins Square. I grew up in the Lower East Side, and, like, you know, in my whole life, every Saturday in the summer, you know, from like May until September, there were concerts in the park, you know, and most of the riots that happened, you know, the famous riots of the East Village kind of started at the end of concerts in the park, and you know, it was just kind of a very central place in my imagination and my memory and my life. And it was very disheartening, to say the least, when it was demolished in 91 or 92. And so around the 10th anniversary of the Bandshell's demolition, I started getting this, like, desire to create some kind of ghost. Like, not a memorial, you know, just this, like, temporary presence of the Bandshell back in the park again. And so I started thinking that I would propose to the Public Art Fund to make, you know, a structure out of, like, very thin fiberglass. Oh my God, pardon me. Everyone else, please turn your ringers off. That I would make a very thin structure out of fiberglass that would trace... Okay, now it's off. That would trace the shape of where the Bandshell was. And, but because, like, I mean, I'm talking about a ghost, and, like, I mean, it's metaphorical, but there's also, you know, you're dabbling in kind of, I was dabbling in the macabre, you know, and the idea that there is such a thing as the ghost, you know, that I was trying to evoke. And so I thought, I need to have some kind of ritual to really make this work. So before I submitted my application to the Public Art Fund, and before I got it all in mind, I decided I would have, like, an evocation of the ghost. And so I started, there was a lot of construction going on the Lower East Side at the time. So I thought, how does one get in touch with the ghost of a building? You know, I mean, ghost of a person, you go to the place where they live, their bedroom, you go to their gravesite. It's like, how do you find, you know, the ghost of a building? And so I thought, you know, you need to touch the stuff, you need rubble. And so I started walking all around, like, kind of in a circle out from the park. I would walk through the park and go on these trips and gather rubble from, like, dumpsters and from buildings, you know, anywhere from Delancey Street up to 14th Street. Fill up these plastic bags and bring them to the park until I had, like, a sufficient amount. And then I went to the center of where the Bandshell was, and I kind of laid all the rubble out in this form. and sang a little song that came to mind, and, you know, started thinking of, you know, to try to get in touch with the ghost of the Bandshell. Needless to say, there were, like, some people who were going to play volleyball who were very irritated by my piece, but I think it was pretty beautiful. And so then I submitted the application to the Public Art Fund, and they, of course, rejected me. But the idea of the Bandshell ghost kind of remained in my mind. And so when Shiana invited me to get in touch with 3103 for their piece, I thought, oh my God, let's forget about the structure, let's just do it as this radiophonic, you know, oral presence. I mean, the band show was a site of sound, you know, very much. It was a place where there were just constantly concerts. And so I thought, you know, just like have a ton of the sounds from the band show rebroadcast in that place on a lot of radio. And that was what I thought I would be able to do and I thought would be possible. But it's been actually rather impossible to get my hands on recordings from the park at that time. I found people who made documentaries about recording, and none of them wanted to just kind of like give me material to choose at my own, to choose from what I liked. They all wanted to like work on it collaboratively and didn't have time to work on it collaboratively, so the doors were kind of shut to get those archival recordings that I really wanted to work with. And so, thinking that actually the quality of the radio transmissions is probably going to be pretty poor, I decided that I'm just going to make, you know, a simple mono collage with emblematic sounds. You know, I have sounds of bulldozers in other places in New York, sounds of police, sounds of like the kind of music that I remember from there, and I'm just going to create this simpler collage, which doesn't involve the archival elements. So, at this moment, I don't really know how I feel about that. I'll see how it goes Saturday. That's why it's a bit difficult to talk about it today. And, that's my piece. Very excited to be doing my first public radio transmission. This is my first public radio transmission.
Saturday night.
Yeah. From 7 until the cops told us to go. In the where the band show was, which was on the 7th Street side of the park, in a big open area. I don't think you're going to be able to get it far out of the park, and I don't know if we know the transmission. Do we know the frequency right now? Low on the dial. If you had a Walkman there, yeah, sure.
We're going to bring radio.
Yeah, there'll be radio.
We're going to bring radio.
Sonic memory, like it's in your bones, like, you know, the way when you burn your, you touch a stove and you burn your hand, you keep that feeling in there for a while, because sometimes when you go near the stove, you remember, like you feel the memory, kind of, what's that word where you like smell color, or you see sound, synesthesia, like you have a kind of synesthetic experience of it. I like that exists with sound, too, so it's like a retained memory of what something sounds like, and sometimes I'll hear a sound and it will immediately trigger a certain memory of a sound that's unrelated but that's triggered by it. And that's very ghost like.
At this point, I'd like to open it up for questions. Do you guys have questions or comments, or if you'd like to partake in the discussion at all?
Is there any movement to stop the band show from being knocked down as a warning?
Yeah, no, the community board was completely opposed to it. Actually, the community board, you know, which was very much, there were a lot of strong gentrifying elements in the community board, and they were really psyched for all the renovation of the park. They were psyched for getting rid of homeless people in the park. They were psyched for the elimination of Dinkinsville, which was the homeless village that moved on to 8th Street and the public park. But they were so adamantly opposed to the renovation of the band show because, you know, despite the fact that there were concerts in Rice, there have been concerts there for 60 years. You know, it was like a real center of the neighborhood. And the city just went ahead with it against all of them.
Why did they take it down?
Yeah, who was not? It was pre-Giuliani, right?
Yeah, it was Dinkins. But no, it was from the police commissioners and the mayor's office. They said, you know, you have the band show, it's going to keep being riots and get rid of the band show. Yeah, there's quotes from the shadow back in that time, like quotes from people in Dinkins' office and from the police commissioners. It was essential to get rid of the band show. I was hoping to get, you know, a lot of people make documentaries from film protest. People were making documentaries about like the squatter movement or about the protests going on here. Used to record the concerts that would happen, you know, like in the late 90s, almost all the concerts got recorded. And you know, one thing though, and that's one thing that I really wanted. And then I was hoping to get like recordings from concerts that maybe key on my fidelity of me. That was the company used to do the sound broadcasting. And you know, one weird thing, this is like really lame of me, and you know, I'm making a little confession here. I approached all these people who made documentaries, you know, kind of, that was my initial approach, and got this negative response. And after getting the negative response, I never approached Beyond High Fidelity. I actually went to the juice bar. There was a juice bar next to where the shop used to be. And like went there like twice. And was like, I don't know, like too scared to go in. I felt like, oh my God, what am I going to ask them? Because I was so disheartened by the way everything went with the documentary sound. And so actually on that front, I didn't even try. But that was the other, those were the two sort of archival sounds. There's still time, but I think I've decided it's music only, no language, no archive.
Yeah. Are there archives of the riot?
Yeah, there's a lot of documentaries. You know, there's Paul Gavin's famous documentaries, and there's Clayton Patterson's from Epic Street, and there's documentaries made. And I was just hoping to get people who made documentaries, their source videos, and take them to their source videos.
But
I mean, you're on your Facebook. The documentary people weren't unsupportive. They just wanted to be more collaborative. They didn't have time to do that. So they'll have to wait until future manifestation.
So I handed out this United States frequency allocation map I'll give you guys. Just because this conference is about mapping out the kind of hidden sounds in the urban environment, and this kind of shows you the map of the airwaves and who claims ownership to the public airwaves. You can see all the military applications. There's all kinds of, I don't think this includes the new digital TV high definition. They're taking over different frequencies, but very little of it is publicly accessible, as you see here. A very sad state. Well, I mean, it depends what your definition of
public.
You know, if you say FM is public, how much does the public have input on FM frequencies these days? You know, I think AV radio is probably a very public. The family radio service or the walkie-talkie.
Amateur is sort of a blue-green.
You have to have a license, but that's ham radio, yeah. So those are kind of the only, you know, little.
Is there a couple of walkie-talkies?
It may be that light purple, that mobile. Family radio service is really what they usually call it, and I don't see that.
Well, maybe it's not amateur.
Amateur is usually what they call ham radio.
What is an amateur satellite?
I don't know. It's probably land mobile. It's probably what the family radio is. Not allocated. Boy, that's probably the secret military. Where do you see that? Oh, those are, that's a very low frequencies that are unusable because they're so low. The lower the frequency that bigger the wave that's created. You would need a very giant antenna to create a wave.
That's whale frequency.
Yeah. The whales in the East River have a... It's all different depending on... The coverage, it depends on... You multiply your wattage, which are the generally low wattage, this is a 40 watt, times the height above average terrain that your antenna is. So if you're, the commercial TV stations, the radio stations are all on top of the Empire State Building. We used to be on top of the World Trade Center, and that way they can cover the whole city. there used to be an artist program at the World, on top of the World Trade Center, and I talked to one artist who used a transmitter there, like a one-watt transmitter on top of the World Trade Center. You could hear this broadcast at 23rd Street. So that's how much the height of the antenna really affects
things.
It's often on top of 3 or 4 story buildings, and if there's a 5 or 6 story building next to it, it doesn't go very far. Mm-hmm. If not, it can get usually as far as the eye can see.
It's
kind of very mobile. Take it to one place and broadcast, and then it goes
around. Depending on how big of a tower you can make for your antenna, yeah. Mm-hmm. And use a different transmitter.
How do you notify when the broadcast?
We have a website that lists most of our events that's in that program, and we also have a large emailing list and put out flyers and things like that too. Generally, before we were much more, you know, now we're a legal nonprofit, so we don't do any illegal broadcasts. Other people do that we work with, but. So in our beginning days, when we were doing a lot of those illegal microcasts, we would flyer the neighborhood where people could listen prior to the broadcast so that people would know about it that way. And we'd flyer the area that you could be viewing.
Yeah, it's very tricky how to notify people with something that's not really legal, it's not really sanctioned, but...
And it might not come in.
Yeah, you might not even be able to hear it. That's kind of the beauty of it.
Also depends on your receiving method. I mean, a car usually receives transmission a lot better.
Mm-hmm. There's so car radios or receivers are meant to receive better because you're moving all the time, so your position is, you know, so it's really meant, it's the best receiver there is with a car radio. That helps it live. That could help it move too. Yeah. You get a better, bigger, better.
And if anybody is interested in helping out or participating in 3103 events, we're an open collaborative group, and please feel free to email us. You can email me directly as well. We're always open to talking to people.
Hey, Michelle, how long has your project worked in other cities? Can you talk about that a little bit?
As far as transmitting or just...
Just in general, I mean, the project, is it... Do you find that different places are more, people are more interested in the sounds? Is it urban environments have more rich sounds?
Well, no, I mean, every place has a rich sound. I think, definitely I had different experiences. I did, they've all been very small, I must admit, but I did 2 projects in Vermont. The first one was in Plainfield, Vermont, which is up near northern Vermont. Montpelier, right near Montpelier, which is the capital, and it's a tiny village, very, very tiny, and they have this big campus community station at Bard College, which is basically empty because there's no students there anymore. It's not a residency college. It's like this big, empty radio station. And they were really welcoming and great and had a kind of interesting mix of, basically had 3 people. One was a girl who was just kind of in her 20s, figuring out her life. One was a man, probably in his late 40s, with 3 kids, who lived in a mobile home, like a trailer, who just thought it was cool. And one was a guy who lived in a yurt on a hill. And they were like, each of them had some connection to the station, and so they were interested, and we would go, we would make downloads together. And it was very cool because they were really different kinds of people, but they all shared the same space. And, other places, like in Toronto, it was a lot harder actually because it's a big city and it's hard to find a community within, there's many communities within that city, so that was more like, I mostly worked with a couple of people who were already doing a lot of field recordings, and we spent the day wandering the city and recording, and we did a broadcast. But one thing that's kind of funny is that people have like an idea of what's going to be cool. Like if you give somebody a mini disc recorder and you teach them how to use it, you inevitably get like a recording of a toilet flushing and a dog like drinking water from his bowl. You get all these kind of recordings that people in their head think, wow, that would sound really cool, and they go and they record it. It's kind of interesting
people's preconceptions.
The cliches.
Yeah, or like people. I mean, I do this too. People think, oh, it would be really cool to record blah blah blah, or oh, I bet we should go record that sound because that's so cool. It's like you have to kind of get past that. People thinking about what they're going to record and actually going and listening and recording based on what they hear. Yeah, I think so. When you're recording, you're doing something. You have to think about the process. But you also, if you have headphones and a microphone, you can hear things that you might not hear just along with your ear. So in a way, it's a much heightened experience. But it's also, you can be distracted by the technology doing that.
More of a in terms of bringing in transition or manipulation?
Oh, it's totally open. I mean, if I'm working with people who have computers and want to like run it through their Mac patch, it's fine with me. The main thing is that the source material be there. Most of the things we've done, it's stuff has stayed pretty clean. There hasn't been a lot of time to develop with products, so it's been pretty much just layering sound. I mean, it's already like divorced from the place where you collected it because you recorded it and broadcasting. So it's a different thing, but it's mostly just the concept of what we're doing with playing back these sounds. So in Toronto, somebody called us during the broadcast and they were listening to it, and that was kind of an interesting, and I think they had their TV on and they were like holding up the TV to the phone. There's a kind of interesting interplay between what we were doing and what they were doing and feeding back into each other. So that was kind of fun.
With this unit, one thing that you use with me, and I don't know how you would, or I'm interested in how you address it, that part of the community radio is bringing people together. So what I experienced when I went to one of the students was that I felt really alone, and that kind of difference between bringing people together and very separate. And the only time I remember feeling really together was when Michelle Rosen, had her headphone sets and had two different headphone things, and then I was so happy and relieved that I could experience something with someone else. And I felt myself really separated, and I felt like that kind of detracted from the idea that we had about bringing her. Like, it really affected me, that difference between that.
No, I've said before that I don't think it's the kind of concert situation you would want to go to every night. That's what it is. And I think it specifically does kind of pull you. What it really affects more of like a concert situation or the going to a show. You don't have the communal experience that you usually do going to a show because everyone is separated by what frequency they're listening to. Depending, maybe the five frequencies that everyone has pre-programmed for the commercial stages. So I think it's really more of like a tour of the airwaves. You get to go through and hear what could be on the radio and what is on the radio. And it's also meant to give you a different kind of non-communal concert experience. You know what it's like to be at a concert where you're not perhaps listening to the same thing that the person next to you is. And you're not, it creates that divide on purpose, yes. It totally creates that divide. And I think that's kind of the point. And I agree, I wouldn't want to go to tune in every night to see, you know, everybody. But it's a really unique experience that doesn't kind of happen any other way.
And interestingly, I went to California recently, and there were some transmission artists that were doing a similar project. But they did it outside, and their audience brought boomboxes. But it was like people were spread out enough, but it sort of still felt like you're on the beach with your friends and listening to boomboxes. But it was still affordable.
Our original idea, and we haven't encountered the space to do it yet, was to have it in two separate rooms, one of which is the quiet room, and one of which is the room that you just described, and it's all boomboxes, and the audience gets to decide. The audience plays the boomboxes in that situation, and it is a very communal, interactive experience, but we have yet to do it in a space that has two soundproof rooms. But they're not rooms with doors, and I think the silence of the one room is kind of important. So,
not to mention when you're using contact mics, and like it's a great opportunity to like do these things that usually feed back to some stereo live sound. You're like, wow, you know, you can crank all these things and get like when she was using the contact mic on water and stuff, it would have been feeding back like crazy. But
especially if five people are doing the same thing.
I love how I did it. Participated twice as an engineer, and the first time around, I was like, just really just confusing to me. Like I. And as the night wore on, it got later, and kind of the frequencies, the band starts to change as the hour of the day changes, and it gets later, just radio in general gets weirder, so it becomes harder and harder to tell when you're on one of the free one of these stations, or when you're just on some other pirate station, or some other weird, so it kind of like changes that way, and a lot of times I didn't know who I was listening to, I didn't even know if I was listening to the person who I was supposed to be kind of helping, and the second time around, I was kind of more used to the idea of how it works, so it was a little bit more fun, but I really love not knowing what anybody's listening to. And as a performer, it kind of frees you up, because you're like, you can get so into your thing, and somebody could be listening to you, like, on the other side of the room, not even looking at you, and be totally being moved by you, and it's just kind of nice. Mysterious.
And you don't get the bored reactions too, that like you can't tell if they're bored because of you or because of someone else.
If somebody's bored, they're probably not listening to you.
Right.
Has anyone ever been to a headphone rave? Because that would be an interesting, you know, like you were talking about this lack of communalness, but like part of the free one free thing is that everybody's listening to different music, you know, and that's like, but
the original idea for this came in 94 by a friend of ours, Chuck, who was responding to the rave getting shut down for noise ordinances, and said, well, why don't we do a silent rave?
Right.
That's what you're talking about.
But so with a headphone rave, though, everybody's listening to the same thing, you can still dance, and can still have that like communal dance body kind of thing, and so that would be an interesting comparison between the 2 minute and something
like
that.
Really fucks you guys that, not having a headphone.
I think the rave culture never really embraced it. They did it a couple times, but they never really embraced it because they really enjoy that. The body, the face.
You need the face.
The face.
But we have a late joiner here, our transmitter. Would you like to talk a little? He's also a free 103 artist. So somebody, would you like to talk?
And I'm a part of Neurotransmitter, and we've been around since 2001, and primarily we're a group of artists, about four of us, who are interested very much in radio technology, working with radio in many, many aspects, installation-based practice, graphic design. We also do music, sound work. And we just recently did an artist in residency spot over at Ivy. So primarily we're interested in you know, what maybe new ways of opening up the space of radio and how to use the technology tactically, like, you know, how to use the wiring, how to maybe design something for radio. So I can put the website up here with some past projects if anyone's interested in checking it out. Let's see.
Neurotransmitter.fm, right?
Yeah, the website is neurotransmitter.fm. Let's see, what else? What's been the discussion about?
What we're doing within the second studio. But I was wondering if you would like to talk about your particularly
well fit into this project. Yeah, basically in 2002 we created what's called CommuniPort, and it's a portable transmitter radio backpack. And the name CommuniPort comes from communication, community, municipality, portability. So it's collapsing these terms into one, but kind of like encompassing the concept of the project, having a system, an apparatus that you can take with you while you're walking down the street and be able to broadcast on the fly. The range of the transmission with this thing is a couple blocks. It's not very far, but it also depends on where you're located, height, you know, and what's around you. So right now we're in the middle of designing the second prototype, which will take on a different design, different material. It'll incorporate renewable energy. So that's what we're working on at the moment. Yeah, like rechargeable batteries, maybe lithium or cadmium, nickel batteries, something that you can recharge.
And somebody could wear this backpack with a
something
around the
device. The backpack comes with the 4-channel mixer, microphone, FM transmitter. And you can plug in any accessory like CD player or mini disc player to it. So we're kind of interested in just, you know, the fusion aspect of it. You can burn a CD and then broadcast it, you know, the same moment. So we're very much interested in, you know, and just like I said before, like how to work with radio, but in new ways, new forms.
Have you done specific projects with the Communifor? Like, how does it work in use?
Yeah, mainly so far it's just been in kind of exhibition installations, but we haven't done what we call frequency performance, where we have multiple backpacks and kind of distribute them to different people and have some kind of engagement with all of these backpacks and, you know, expanding the range of the frequency. Yeah, very much so. I mean, depending on the context of what we're participating in, we always have it known that we're broadcasting on a certain station. Exactly. Just going around to the different stores, telling people to tune in to such and such station. But yeah, I mean, I think Tom brought it up earlier, this idea of, you know, the element of surprise is really interesting also, where you're flipping through the station, through the bandwidth, and you're not really sure what you're going to come across on, you know, this could be a surprise to a certain degree. So, I mean, it's part kind of, you know, part the surprise element of it, but also we do like to let it be known that we're broadcasting. No, because we always change it up. Yeah, I mean, for us, it's important to occupy the space of radio and reclaim that space, something that's been, you know, regulated for a long time. So.
And we're talking about teaming up and using some of these and walkie-talkies and cell phones and other sort of communication devices to cover the protest at the Republican National Convention in the first week of September, I guess.
Yeah. No, it's all technology, but in new forms, right? So how do you think about radio differently than what's been done in the past? You know, going beyond just the radio broadcast, but actually incorporating the technology either in a installation practice or, you know, some kind of design element to it. We've also done projects with video. We did a 20-minute montage that references four films that are about radio. So we're kind of interested in anything that's about radio and, you know, bringing it onto our practice in some way. The four films are Radio Bikini, this film FM that came out in the late 70s. It's actually a good film. Pump Up the Volume, and there's this like 1920s, 30s Gene Autry film. I forgot the title of it, but it takes place, you know, out in the Wild West, but with a radio station. Yeah. Oh, did I? Oh, no, no, no. Oh, there's five. The other one is talk radio. I recommend that.
You have the. What do you have next? The other recording?
Yes, we have the 4 p.m.
But I guess I have one thing to say. One thing that I like about Trimilitary and our work is that the Marxist idea of like through production and through doing systems of relations where building the home idea of kind of relaxing, you know, and as we do a lot of radio broadcasts, the radio broadcast that I do is more for me about the event, bringing people together and having, you know, there's definitely a lot more people involved in the broadcast than, you know, and, you know, there's always like 20 or 30 people running around doing that, and then there's like four people listening around, you know, so like, but for me, the actual broadcast is often sort of a residue of that normally happen. And the other reason that I like it is I like to create concepts that people don't conceive of as concepts where, you know, you would go in an organization with the people who then sit for each other in the library. So if I say I'm having radio broadcasts, you know, perform, then musicians will come and people will talk about them. But they'll interact in kind of, you know, unusual things, and that's really interesting. And so, you know, so
it's not so much the pressure of the audience and the performer.
I feel like I'm used to the drop. 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 I fe